This is the Average Guy Network, and you have found Home Gadget Geek show number 684 with guest Christian Johnson, recorded on July 16th, 2026. Here on Home Gadget Geeks, we cover all the favorite tech gadgets that find their way into your home. News, reviews, product updates, and conversation, all for the average tech guy. I'm your host, John Collison, broadcasting live from the AverageGuy.tv studios here in a sweltering, where you have some kind of heat dome, Christian, going on right now here in Bellevue over us.
It's 100 here, yeah.
100 degrees. It is July, right? I mean, we should be, I was complaining about this last week. Heat is my least favorite thing. Given the choice, super cold, super hot, what do you choose, Christian? What's your thought on that?
I'd much rather be super cold than super hot. I know it sounds weird, but that's where I'm at.
That's me. Yes. Although, I mentioned this last week, the coldest coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in my house. Sarah keeps the thermostat. She left. She left for the week. She's at her sister's place. When I came in, the house was at 67. I was like, oh my God, what are we doing here? So I kind of bumped it up a little bit, right? And she keeps it frigid in here. So I'm always cold all summer long. I'm kind of anxious when winter gets here so I can warm up a little bit. Anyways, we post a show with some world-class show notes. We'll have a few of them out there at theaverageguy.tv. Big thanks to our Patreon subscribers. You guys pay the bills or help me pay the bills each and every month. Head out to theaverageguy.tv/Patreon if you want to join that team. There's a few spots out there. $1 $5 plan, do it for 1 month or as many as you want. Most of you have been hanging around for a long time. So thanks for doing that. And then if you want to click on the Amazon affiliate link on the site, head out to theaverageguy.tv, upper right-hand corner. Click through it. Helps the network, all those other good things. Many of you have done that. Christian and I built this Amazon affiliate manager. You know, we talked about OpenClaw a while ago. On OpenClaw, it's a challenge. We got it done. Maybe we'll talk about it in the post show a little bit as we talk about that a piece. But that helps me manage all those links and such. Sort of, it's supposed to anyways. We'll figure out how that works. Out at theaverageguy.tv, you can click on that. Christian's with me tonight. Christian, you reached out to me a month or two ago and said, hey, I'm working on this new thing with Bitwarden, and I want you to try it. And I quickly didn't do it. All these other things are going on. And then I was like, I don't really know what I'm doing.
Do you know the funny part is that was actually an answer to maybe 3 or 4 podcasts back that I was on with you where you said, hey, if you're interested, it would be really cool if I could test out hosting that on Maple Grove with you. And I said, I probably need a little bit of time. And then I did it. And you were like,
I didn't do it. I got crazy on working on some, OpenClaw and Hermes and doing some, how am I plugging that into the website? And it works really, really well with WordPress and some of those kinds of things. And then at some point I thought, I don't even know where I should start on this thing. So before we dig into that and talk about like the mechanics of what you're talking about, let's talk a little bit about the state of password managers in 2026, right? And, these password managers from the old days, so to speak, are here because we needed a username and a password to be able to get into sites. Mm-hmm. Pass keys have started coming on the scenes, and many of the sites that I'm in are using these pass keys, right? And now I can store my pass key in Bitwarden, but that's a whole nother thing. And then, of course, with my phone, I'm doing Face ID for a lot of stuff. So, Christian, as we think about the state of password managers in 2026, give me your thoughts on where are we today in your opinion?
I think we are definitely moving very quickly towards the passkey as the predominant authenticator. So I do think like the concept of calling it a password manager is maybe a slightly better way is to say it's a credential manager at this point.
Okay.
If you think about going from just passwords that were then salted in a database and comparing the salt to then putting some type of like two-factor where it used to be like password and I'll text you. And then, you know, the texting codes got SIM hijacked, right? So then we moved to authenticator apps like Google Authenticator, et cetera, because that wasn't something that was susceptible to SMS intercept. And then kind of the next iteration was these push to approve apps, like click here to sign in, and that would get pushed to your phone if you did the traditional login. Then kind of like the hardest standard would be like the actual physical hardware security key, like a YubiKey or something that does the FIDO or U2F standard. And so I think the trade-off spectrum is like what people I think found the easiest was a weak password, nothing else. And what people found the most complex was carrying around these different hardware tokens and plugging them in. And, you know, you can't plug a hardware token into your phone, but then if you lock it down to 2FA and you only set up a hardware token, so it just became this like errata of baggage, so to speak. And so I think the passkeys are becoming really interesting because it's, I think, for the first time getting people to a place where they don't have to choose between convenience and security. And that's going to be interesting for the, like, the password manager market, because I really do think that they're going to all have to standardize around just managing your passkeys and managing your authenticators. And I think passwords will just continue to kind of become less and less relevant. Now, I think there are some areas where it's going to take a while to replace passwords, like particularly if you think about older protocols and standards, like it's going to take forever for them to figure out how to do passkeys with something like IMAP or your email being pushed to your phone, right? Like there's some, I would say, lower level protocols that will take some time or take some more time, but certainly like logging into websites or doing mobile apps, I think passkeys are going to start becoming the leading credential pretty shortly here.
What makes email different than, you know, I think when I log into Amazon now, I think I use my pass key for it. What makes that different than a traditional e-commerce site?
It doesn't if you're accessing it like via a web browser, right? Okay. But if you're, let's say, doing it via like an Outlook or a Thunderbird client or something like that, it's a bit of a different story.
There is a push. I am seeing a little bit from Microsoft of a push for all web client moving off of some of those standards. Is that just people overcoming that, or do we just have so many embedded systems that are, you know, you think about Outlook and all in IMAP, right? Some of those pieces, is that just so embedded in what we're doing? We're just gonna have to move away from it at some point.
It's a good question. You know, it reminds me of, I don't know if you use Quicken at all to manage your finances, but like part of the reason why Intuit and Quicken have such a hold on that market is that they are kind of the only ones that maintain this weird proprietary, now I don't know that it's proprietary, but it is a very squirrely standard for how they pull and download data from the banks. And Money Dance, I think, is like, and there's a couple others that have tried, but like they just can't keep up with the feature set or the size of Intuit. They just get crushed every time. And so like that reminds me of one of those like really deep in the weed plumbings where like when you think about the different ways now, Quicken has changed like every 6 months, like how to connect to different types of banking institutions for downloading that data, right? And so it kind of reminds me of something similar here where like, oh man, IMAP and POP are just such embedded protocols for a lot of mail clients that you don't change that quickly. So it's not even really so much about users adopting it as it is like the industry figuring out what is the thing to migrate to that supports more advanced authentication standards built into these protocols. It's much the same reason why, like if you set up POP with your Gmail, it's an app password that you generate. It's not your like account password. You generate an app password that's only used by that protocol, but there's no like, you know, you don't open up Outlook or Thunderbird and say, you know, press your two-factor authenticator or like get your push notification for the emails to start downloading, right? So there's no two-factor authentication inherently possible inside those protocols. So then the question is, okay, like what protocols are we going to move to for supporting those types of clients? And I don't mean client as like the customer. I mean, it as like the front end software.
I have given Hermes, I've been using Hermes, and its excuse for its existence is to be my YouTube manager. And given it that title and said, I want you to help me keep track of, post, work on, make efficient, pull data from, right? The YouTube authorization, besides the AI side of things, which is its own craziness, the authorization craziness that is Google in getting, you know, to getting those, all those authorizations, getting in the console, right? Getting in the console and going to your API and figuring that out. And then the different security levels that exist in one account, it's one account, right? Now I have a couple different YouTube channels, so there's some complexity there, but the different APIs for writing, reading, analytics, right? Those different pieces that you want to get from them, they all have their own token. And then getting the AI to actually understand those tokens and not mismap them or miswrite them. Now, some of it's probably my fault because I'm doing some of these setups late at night or whatever, and I might be clicking the wrong buttons. But boy, the Google authentication piece has been interesting. And that seems to be different than everybody else. I don't know. Do you, any thoughts on that? Have you had any experience in that space at all?
With Google specifically?
Yeah. Google specifically.
I have their, I think they call it their Titan key. I think this is it.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen this, but they, this was back when they were making those. I don't have the other. Do I have the other one on my desk? I might. Let's see. Here we go. Here's the other one. This one was kind of cool. The FITAN key. So this was like supposed to be the NFC Bluetooth one. And then this was the hard key. And so like, I know that I don't worry about whether or not my Gmail is going to get hacked because the only way I can get into my Google is with one of these things. And I just decided that because I just never wanted to deal with a Gmail getting hacked. It just sounded horrible. I think I got the kit for free. I don't quite remember, but at the time they were, I think, $25. And I think a lot of that's changed. Now a lot of providers, like if you want that level of security, they'll just send you the keys for free. Like for example, AWS will just send you hardware keys for free if you sign up for an account, because that's how much the company believes in, you know, securing accounts with multi-factor authentication. So that's personally what I've done with Google. I really have steered away for, I never really did their Google Authenticator app or any of the other kind of like middle tier apps. I have Duo Mobile for when there's random stuff that wants to do the Authenticator apps and whatnot, but I've tried to migrate as much of that as possible into Passkeys and Bitwarden. There's a couple places that don't integrate very nicely with that ecosystem where I still use the Duo Mobile to generate, you know, one-time codes for the second factor. That's kind of my fallback right now.
We're going to talk about Bitwarden here. There are other providers out have for the most part, are we moving to passkeys? You'd mentioned before you've thought that's probably the perfect intersection of security and convenience for those sites that are supporting it. Man, I'll tell you what, it's a super easy setup. I mean, it's almost better than, it's like Face ID for the PC, right? Which, by the way, why can't we get Face ID on the PC? Like, why can't,
I know,
right? Like,
sad,
can't be that hard, right? It would be super cool to be able to do that, but maybe someday. Even on the Mac, it's next to impossible. But so Bitwarden's in that space. Are there others? Is everybody keeping up if you're on OnePass or some of the other ones?
I think they all are. I think they all have it at this point. I personally like just tuned everyone else out after I got Bitwarden the way I like it. But I'm fairly certain that you can go out there and find a dozen options pretty easily, and they're all subscription-based and they'll all support passkeys.
Okay. Okay. And the reason, so last time we chatted about password managers or credential managers, as I'm going to start calling them now, now that you've retitled those Provincial Manners. No, it's a good, I'll do a diff statement and see, okay, no, I'm going to add that to the instructions. And from here on out, we're going to just call it a credential manager. We had been talking, you and I had been talking about it, and I kind of moved everything from LastPass into Bitwarden. I actually need to do some maintenance. I have so many freaking passwords on that. But we had talked about moving it to a cloud service. I think with Bitwarden, you can buy that. And I think at some point you thought, you know what, we could kind of do this at Maple Grove Partners.
Yeah.
And I did say to you, I remember that I did say to you, oh, if you did that, I would do it. And then you did it. This would be a month or two. Has it been maybe three? I'm sorry. It's been crazy. For both you and me. What's the advantage? Help me. Let's review a little bit on that. What's the advantage of doing that? And rather than just having it local or downloading it or using the free service, what's the advantage?
So the biggest advantage of having it on a connected system like that is the fact that you can sync it, have it synced between all your devices. And even if you're not on a device that you own, like, I don't know, say you're on a library computer or something out there, like you could still put in your master password, get into your credential manager, get what you need, move on with life. That said, you can do that with creating and managing your account at bitwarden.com just as much as you could self-hosting it. So as much as this probably undermines my own, you know, little business concept here, you got to be pretty tinfoil hatty to be like, yeah, I need to self-host it because I don't trust the encryption having it client encrypted on bitwarden.com. So really there is no material advantage in my opinion. There is probably some nominal warm and fuzzy for folks that truly don't want any of their bits stored on infrastructure that they don't control. So I just personally like it because I can put it on my own domain name. I can set up my own license with it. You can have users invited into your particular instance. But it's the exact same feel as bitwarden.com. It's not a different feel. And then I think because it's, I can't remember if it's open source from Bitwarden. I'm pretty sure it is. There is a fork of it called Vaultwarden, which is an unofficial lightweight open source equivalent of Bitwarden developed in Rust. So if you wanted to use Vaultwarden as a self-hosted, which is something that I might do as well as an alternative hostable option, that gives you the same experience without needing the premium subscriptions from Bitwarden. So you get quite a bit of a bang for your buck with the free subscription, free license, if you will, self-hosted with Bitwarden. But if you wanted to truly get kind of the exciting features without dealing with paying an annual subscription to Bitwarden, self-hosting Vaultwarden would probably give you a bit more value than just saying, oh, look, I'm hosting the same Bitwarden product, but by myself instead of going through the company. So
from a encryption standpoint, and I've been trying to log in, I set this up, I think after the show, I think I set it up and we were going to do something with Maple Grove Partners. And I thought, well, I'll just go with the initial offering that Bitwarden has. I was trying to figure out if I'm paying for it or if it's free. What's the advantage to having that hosted by Maple Grove Partners? And how do you have that set up right now? How would that work for people? What's the value proposition?
Yeah, so it's cool. Just like you would go to Maple Grove Partners, pick your web hosting package, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same concept here. You'd go to Maple Grove Partners, you'd order the Bitwarden product. We offer by default a like hosted subdomain, so you can pick your own name under maplegrovehosting.com. So like, yeah, I don't know, jimcwarden.apps.maplegrovehosting.com could be your subdomain. We generate the SSL search, the whole nine yards. When you order the product, it automatically provisions and stands up the Bitwarden container, and it emails you your setup info. And then you can start using all the Bitwarden plugins. Like, I have Bitwarden in my browser. I have it on my iPad. I have it on my iPhone. I've used the web browser interface directly as well. So I have kind of like four different ways of working with it. And then you can get all of those benefits without, I guess in this instance, being worried about being in the managed like Bitwarden.com subscription environment. And you can run that as the free version. And then, like I said, I might swap it out and or add the ability to provision Vault Warden instead of Bitwarden so that you can get even more, kind of more feature set without having a license file.
Does a feature set change at all if I'm using Bitwarden as opposed to whether I'm having them host it or you host it?
It shouldn't, which is why it's a bit more of like the tinfoil value, right? Because, you know, like if you want your own domain name, then you got to self-host it, right? If you want, I don't quite know if the sharing, how the sharing works of like, I can share parts about my vault with things about your vault, but I don't know if I would have to be in Bitwarden.com's instance for that, or if you have to be in the self-hosted. So it's much like, the difference between WordPress.org and WordPress.com is actually maybe the best analogy, right? Like, you could go make a website today at WordPress.com, mm-hmm. and kind of get your stuff going and put a domain name on it, and that'd be great. And that's the commercial version of WordPress. Or you could find your self-hosted option and download the same exact software of WordPress, which is put in through the foundation at WordPress.org, and run it and maintain it yourself. So it's kind of the same business model there. It has been a while since I've deep dived like the niche differences between self-hosted and the managed, but it should be pretty nominal, much like in theory, it's pretty nominal the differences between WordPress.com and .org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are you, and I'll remind folks, you know, theaverageguy.tv is hosted. You hear me say this at the end of every podcast, right? Christian and Maple Grove Partners is hosting theaverageguy.tv, both web and media hosting, which whenever time I tell podcasters that, they're like, wait, media is being hosted? I'm like, yeah, he's hosting it. Can he do that? Yeah. You don't have to have your own. He's doing that as well. He's hosting all 84 will get posted this weekend. Plus all the Cyber Frontiers, all the other crazy stuff that we've done over time. Christian, what are you charging for this? How do I get into this if I wanted to do something like this and move on to it?
Yeah, I have no idea yet. In fact, I don't remember what price SKU I put out for it. So part of asking you to play with it was like, hey, what do you think? Like, what value do you think people would find in this?
We can ask too. We can get some feedback here tonight, and the folks in chat, you know, you can throw that in the chat if you're thinking about it. But what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I think part of doing this experiment was not just Bitwarden, but the engine that we built for Maple Grove was for people to be able to bring any type of managed container hosting to the environment, which is kind of a bit of a shift from just doing web and web email and media hosting of like, hey, if I have this application, like, yeah, if you get it into a Docker container, like, we'll make hosted versions of it available to customers. So almost having like a mini container registry of approved containers that people can host or launch. So different containers, different applications have way different demand profiles. Bitwarden happens to be extremely low CPU, RAM, disk requirements. So I feel like we could sell these things very cheap and have fun with it. So like maybe $5 a month, I don't know. And, you know, especially with Vault Warden. So Vault Warden gives you all those premium features that the Bitwarden free wouldn't give you, which is why we might switch it out to Vault Warden when we go live for real. So with Vault Warden, you get the premium org features, you get the TOTP storage, you get attachments, you get multiple org and collection management. And typically when you get that through Bitwarden, that's when you're paying those different subscription tiers. So that might be ultimately where there is the best value is like, hey, the cost to do this on Maple Grove via Vault Warden gives you more feature set than if you were to pay the managed subscription through bitwarden.com. And you're going to get the same, all the same security benefits and standards because it's essentially the Bitwarden code base. It's nothing that, you know, we as a hosting provider are developing. It's all community managed through Bitwarden.
Joe out in the chat had said they use Vault Warden with a Cloudflare tunnel to get that done.
Yep.
Yeah,
a lot of people do put these behind like VPNs. They don't want them on the internet, etc. So that's another reason why people do choose to self-host. But
different than, okay, I mean, when you say self-host, I mean, Bitwarden, if I'm at Bitwarden and I've got an account through them, am I safe? Is that a bad idea?
It's totally fine. Like the cryptographic principles they've implemented are the same, whether it's self-hosted or cloud-hosted.
Okay. So I could do that either way. The real question of like moving it to a Maple Grove Partners is you control it. You get to control the domain. You get to control the security. Am I right on that one? Is that the real advantage of that? Is choice?
It's choice. I mean, again, I think that it's not any different than the choice between WordPress.com or WordPress.org. Yeah. And, like it's the same software, but that's where I think the Vault Warden difference will matter to potential customers. It's just that you'll get those extra features without the price.
Okay. We get a couple hundred folks to listen to the show every single week. What would be helpful from a feedback perspective, Christian@theaverageguy.tv is still working. So if you want to give Christian some feedback on this, but Christian, what would be helpful for you to hear? To see if you would move forward with something like this.
What people would be willing to pay for it, what people's experience are provisioning it. Like I gave you, I think, some test credits to go try it out. So if other folks were interested in kind of betaing it for me, I'd go register at maplegrovepartners.com and I'll put some test money on your account and you can kind of
trial it out
for a few months and just give me feedback on like, hey, does this help with any use cases? And then the other thing I'd actually really like feedback on is this project was really to start moving into being able to support container hosting as opposed to just a particular app. So I'd love to hear from people like, what are your most popular Docker containers that you have running off in some squirrely corner of your basement closet that you would, you know, prefer to have running on a managed hosting provider for cheap?
Christian, when you think about that, okay, my immediate thought was Docker. So I was thinking like I could run, you know, how can I run these AI instances on them? How much of a challenge, you know, the data center craziness is happening, right? And everything. The reason RAM and GPU and CPU prices are crazy is just because the demand is so high. That's got to be when we think about AI compute. That's a thing, right? Everybody's thinking. Is anybody still thinking about just like regular storage and that kind of stuff, or is it all compute? Are we thinking about as compute at this point?
I think it's all GPUs at this point. And I mean, conversely, all the things that come with GPUs, which are high performance SSDs and RAM chips, but
yeah,
only for the purposes of filling data into the GPUs as fast as possible.
Well, okay, I was going to say that. One of the things I've learned as I've been working over the last, you know, couple months in this is you do still have to have space. Like you have to write stuff somewhere. And so while all this pressure is on RAM, the super fast RAM, there still is a little bit of a race for storage, right? I mean, you got to store all these things that I think about, you know, in a lot of the code that I'm now having, you know, AI write for me, we're doing a lot of back and forth with the code, right? So I'm in ChatGPT and I'm like, hey, I'm trying to do this thing. And it says, here's a chunk of code. And I go over to OpenClaw and I go into the terminal and I give it that code and say, you know, do this thing. And we go, it's sometimes we go back and forth with giant chunks of code. Now, text is small by nature, but you start repeating that. I'm thinking of people repeating that over and over again. And in some cases, I mean, I'm doing it kind of a archaic way where I'm copy and pasting back and forth. If you're having the AI do that for you, right, doing the code, Claude Code, or however some of those kind of work, I mean, behind the scenes, like, it doesn't care. It's writing, right? I mean, thoughts on that? I mean, there's still a demand for space, right? And that?
There's a demand for space, but, I mean, a big part of it is space co-located with your GPU compute.
Right.
So, like, I'm obviously not hosting a bunch of high-end GPUs in my environment currently. It's more of a traditional compute environment with traditional storage. I have plenty of storage, but it's not just about how many bytes of durable storage you have. It's about how fast is that storage. And so if you're actually doing like model training or development, for example, or large scale inference that has, you know, big context windows, you're going to want that high speed storage co-located with high performance GPUs.
Yeah.
And that's a very specific type of infrastructure environment, which is why a lot of people just say, screw it, I'm going to pay for the subscription to go use my foundational model provider of choice and call it a day.
Yeah. Kevin Schoonover says in chat, he says Seagate and Western Digital are both sold out.
Of course.
On high capacity drives, right?
Of course.
And so there is, you know, there's a race for space in some regards. Who was telling me, was it Gavin? I can't remember. They had to RMA a drive and it was like an 8 terabyte drive. And they sent it in and there was nothing. They're like, we have nothing to send you. And eventually, 3, 4, 5 weeks later, a very used 8 terabyte drive showed up to them, kind of thing. Like those high capacity drives are in high demand at this point. So I know I was talking to you a little bit earlier when we were talking earlier about buying stuff like PCs and like, you know, how crazy it is right now. One, I'm a big advocate. I tell people all the time, don't buy anything right now. Just don't.
I know.
Like, it's crazy. Don't buy anything right now. Just sit back and relax. But live in the moment. I think these are times that they don't happen all the time. I mean, the amount of change, all the things that are happening, all the crazy globalness of global politics. Don't despair. I mean, we all want to despair sometimes. But I think to sit back and go, you know, these are times we're going to talk about in the future. Don't you think this is a moment where, like, remember when this happened?
100%. Yeah, 100%. In fact, I feel like I'm already starting to build that picture about what's happened over the last year. Like, remember when we were just looking at Sonnet 3.5 and we thought, oh, this is all fake. This is not anything that people would do something serious with. And then 6 months that changed to, oh, there might be some use cases. And then 6 months it changed to, oh, we're going to be at AGI in 2 years. So it's like, you know, this is going to be changing really fast.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that just from a frontier model perspective. Everybody's in a race to the, even so much, Christian, you know, I spend a lot of time with ChatGPT talking to it in my car. That's just a great time for me to have conversations and work out some details and that kind of stuff. Over the last 3 or 4 days, that voice has changed 3 times. Like, they're making these significant changes that are the regular voice, I didn't change anything. I didn't change any settings. I'm getting a different person, so to speak. Even so much so that 2 days ago, it started coughing. It literally coughed. Like, that's, it was like, really weird. It was like, and I'm like, what did you do? It's like, oh, I'm sorry. I was, I'm like, well, wait a minute. Did you need to do that?
Yeah.
Like, I just am kind of, And it's like, no. I get the point. I get this, that we're trying to get to a spot where those things, they're trying to make us feel comfortable and make it feel like it's a person. But they're not. They're an AI. I don't need them to be a person. I need them to be smart, right? I need them to not make the mistakes of, oh, I was doing mental math. You're a computer. Don't do mental math. You don't have to do mental. That's what humans do because we're not designed like you, right?
Right.
And so I'm a little like some of the new frontier models that are coming out. You mentioned Fable a little bit earlier. I haven't messed with that very much. Yeah, we do have access to it. What's your gut on the state? I mean, it's just a race right now going on right now. And then you'd mentioned earlier, you know, we were talking about DeepSeek, you know, a year or two ago, and there's a new model from China. Talk a little bit about what's the state of the frontier, so to speak, as we think about those frontier models.
Yeah, I mean, if we had done this show even a week ago, I mean, it would have been a very easy answer. And I think it still is, in my opinion, that, Fable/Mythos is the latest and greatest on the frontier. Nothing else really fully lights a torch to it. GPT-5.6 is kind of the close runner up, but I mean, it took some time for them to, quote, get close. So Anthropic has generally been putting out the highest performing models the earliest, even though they do so at much higher cost footprint. And that has kind of narrowed quite a bit now. So then you have both Anthropic and OpenAI with, I would say, pretty close general class frontier models. Obviously, I think Mythos is still a little bit in a league of its own from the cyber variant of OpenAI 5.6. And then what you've been seeing with XAI has been pretty interesting because they recently just came out with a model that, Elon says isn't, you know, the cutting edge Fable, but it's an Opus class model at a fraction of the cost and also at a fraction of the hardware footprint. Like it can run on older hardware like H200s, which is actually pretty cool. And then this data point today dropped where Kimi K3, which is a Chinese-based model, just dropped. And it's like just a squeak behind where Fable and GPT-5.6 are at in the intelligence benchmark. And cost-wise, it is less expensive than both OpenAI and Fable, which is really interesting. And so there's a very cool site where you can look at all this called just artificialanalysis.ai. And they have some really just easy to digest and understand graphs where you can break down intelligence, speed, and cost scores of each of the models. And you can, you know, really break down and get into the weeds about what different models have been benchmarked for doing the best, which ones are proprietary, which ones are open weight. And so this is just a really cool way to navigate the space and how quickly things are changing. And one of the graphs that I love or I find interesting, so yeah, this first three box that you're looking at is the visual picture is worth 1,000 words. This would just be describing the last 3 minutes of me talking. And then if you scroll further down, there's this cool graph. Keep going. One more. Yeah, this one I think is pretty neat. So this gives you just a sense of,
it's the frontier, though, if for those listening, frontier language model intelligence over time.
Yeah, so this just kind of shows you the horse race that we're in, right? And what's cool is that it gives you this nice timelined benchmark going back to November 22nd when it's just OpenAI hanging out there at the beginning.
GPT 3.5.
Yeah.
Turbo. Then, does it have a little turbo button on it?
I know. Give me more gas. And just to see the step laddering between these different models is really cool in this graph. And it just shows you like, oh my gosh, in what, like 3 years, we've gone from barely scoring over 10% to hitting 60% on the intelligence scores. Like to me, that's pretty stunning. So it'll be really interesting to see how this shapes up. I guess also on here is the, I didn't mention the Meta and Google models, which are also pretty closely looked at and have good adoption as other US models as well. So yeah, there's about five big names in the US in the model space. And then there's a lot of open source models, and then there's a lot of
ones too.
Yeah. So, yeah, just a really cool site to get a sense for how quickly this space is moving.
I put that link in the show note, or I mean, I put that link in chat for live folks. It'll be in the show notes if you want to go out and take a look at it. And it's one of those data, you know, it's kind of one of those data sites you could go to that give you some idea. It's got to be changing though, Christian, just on a daily basis, right? And you know, you mentioned cost, and when the world is unlimited, as it is right now in some regards, like these AI companies are losing a lot in what they're doing. They're making some too, but when this tightens up and we actually get some reality in here on some of these things, and we actually have to start paying real costs for this, there's some real doom and gloom going on. As we think about the bubble bursting, I'm hearing that all the time, the AI bubble burst, both, I think in a lot of cases, when they're talking about that AI bubble, most are talking about the data center bubble that's happening, right? Or the compute. Mm-hmm. That's another one we should probably change the name of. Those are really compute centers, not data centers. I mean, they are, but they're really compute centers. Do you, you got any thoughts on the, you know, when we actually have to pay for what this really is? What does that look like? Yeah, any opinions or any thoughts on that, what that could look like here in the future?
In that medium term, I think it looks like the have and the have nots, because, you know, you can create applications today for $100 a month that in a couple of years from now, maybe would cost you $20,000 a year. So it's just, I think going to be, tokens are going to be like a new form of currency. And then this gets me into a very philosophical discussion with you all about how crypto and tokenization of assets starts interplaying between what's an asset, how do you meter that asset, how do you define intrinsic value? And so, yeah, when you have real world assets sitting on a blockchain, and now you're saying tokens themselves, which is generative work or generative compute capability, I think you're increasingly going to see, it's not even really going to be about how many dollars you have in your pocket. It's going to be about like how many tokens do you have in your pocket. And I think that's going to be on the blockchain, and not just because of humans, but because agents are going to buy services from each other. Mm-hmm. So you're going to have agents working on behalf of entities that have capital deployed on the blockchain, and those agents are going to be authorized to do tasks that require capital. And so that's why I'm a huge Ethereum bull, if folks haven't figured that out yet over the last few shows, is because like there's got to be a place for all the AI agents to run and participate in a digital economy that is not human-centric. And Ethereum is the only place where you can do that at scale. And it's also has this huge adoption of layer two. So, and if you see what's going on with Robinhood and some of these other things, like I think Ethereum is currently at a record for staking, and there's no one in the exit queue, and there's a whole bunch of people in the input queue. So I think Ethereum is going to have its day here. And I think you're going to see a recovery in the ETH to Bitcoin ratio chart. And I think a part of that is because there's absolutely been a disconnect between price lagging fundamentals. Fundamentals are all-time strength while price is just in the gutter. However, if you look at this from a fundamentals, part of the reason why I'm so fundamentally bullish on it is that there just is no other technology that allows AI agents to so easily participate in digital capital, digital decisions. So I do think that's where a lot of it's going to go. I'm not saying this is going to happen overnight, but like all things in the AI space, it's going to happen sooner than we think.
Yeah. Any coincidence that the blockchain uses the term tokens and the AI also used the term token?
Any coincidence there?
Was it convenient? Well, was it just convenient? Like,
I actually don't. I probably need to go do some academic research there on like who invented the word token in these different contexts. But
Seems I don't disagree with you. I mean, it's a match made in heaven for those systems to talk to each other or to exchange with each other. I'm kind of doing that now with the agents. You know, I have browser tabs open for ChatGPT and for Claude, and Perplexity's next to it, and Grok is sitting there as well. Using ChatGPT is my primary source of help. I don't even want to say truth, but primary source of health. That's where most of my conversations and in engineering and things I'm building and things I'm thinking about, that's where that's living today. But it has admitted itself as we were spending some time chatting. It was like, you know, you ought to really use Claude as an editor. It's really good at that. And yeah. And so I was like, so we create things. In fact, a lot of the posts that have been going on at theaverageguy.tv lately, making those, working with those on my experiences. So this is ChatGPT taking my experiences with it. So this is all legitimate. We're not making stuff up. These are all things that I've done. Right, all projects I've worked on ChatGPT, there's no way I could remember all the details of all the things that we did. So it's been super helpful to reconstruct those stories, right? Put those things out. We send it over to Claude. Mm-hmm. And if we need to do research, ChatGPT is like, oh yeah, use Perplexity for that. It's really good at the research end of things, right? Whatever. And I'm like, okay, I've got Gemini as well. And like, okay, we can use Gemini in this way. I'm kind of doing that model, what you're talking about, mostly because they're not connected together yet. But in a world, do you see a world where they're buying and selling services from each other? Is that what you're saying?
100%.
Yeah. Do you think some of that's happening already?
I would say on a limited basis. I think right now it's more like cutesy experiments than anything materially like
what's stopping it? Like what's stopping it from happening? Just not a need, or are we just not technically there yet?
I think people just haven't quite figured it out yet. Like it is very frontier to just say, here, agents, here's $1 million, go do what is in the best interest of the business and trust that all those things are going to happen.
Yeah.
But that's absolutely where we're going. Like, I have no doubt we're going there. I think it's more of a human release comfort than it is a technical viability comfort. Yeah. Technology is all there.
Well, but Christian, I mean, I've been working with some of these where we're working on a project. It's getting late. I've stopped paying it. I mean, I am moving these transactions back and forth. Hey, do you want to do this? I want it that way. Okay, let's run this code. Okay, here's what I found. Like we're going back and forth on it, right? And I take my eye off it for a second. And all of a sudden, man, pow, it shoots down this avenue of like, oh, I thought you wanted to. Let me give you an example. So I have on OpenClaw, I have it run a script that goes to OpenAI and pulls the usage for my OAuth connection for OpenAI. It's kind of the way I feed OpenClaw into OpenAI. It's how it gets, you know, I've got that subscription. That's how it gets tokens so it can do stuff. And for the longest time, OpenAI had in that script, I guess it's going against an API. I would think it would be, but something along those lines. It had a 5-hour script and a 168-hour script. So it said, here's how much usage you have for the next 5 hours. This is how they keep you from going crazy on the thing when you're only paying $20 a month, right? And then in a week, in any given week, you have this much time. And when you run out of time on the 5, it comes off against the 168. I mean, I think we know how that works, right? It's just a metering device. Somehow, a couple of days ago, OpenAI just took out the $5 or the 5-hour one. This disappeared. Mm. Like, gone. Okay. No longer works on that script. We're only going to go with the week one. And then they're resetting it at weird times. Okay. That's beside the point. The question was how the AI handled it. All of a sudden, my dashboards broke because the 5-hour measure wasn't there anymore. And I'm like, hey, why isn't this showing up anymore? So I started working with ChatGPT on this. And at some point, it was just assumed. It was like, okay, it's gone. Let's rewrite everything. And I get to a point where it's rewritten the dashboards. It's redone the metrics. It's like, and it's like, here you go. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. All I wanted you to do is troubleshoot this thing.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't looking for a solution, but partially my fault. We were going down this path and I was just agreeing. Okay, yeah, that looks good. That's good. Until I finally stopped. I was like, okay, wait a minute. What are you doing to this kind of thing? Right. And so there's some of that too, right? Where, I mean, I still think the authority, right, and guardrails and some of these kinds of things, because it will just, this generativeness of it, if we can call it that, will go off and do its own thing if you let it, you know? I don't know. Any thoughts on that and experiences you've had around on that kind of experience?
Yeah, I think it's the difference between vibe wandering and like having structured.
Vibe wandering. I like that. We're getting all kinds of new terms today, yeah. Christian.
Nice. Yeah, I must be in a mood. I don't know. But yeah, the difference between vibe wandering and really having structured rules and guardrails is part of the context that you give it. So it totally doesn't surprise me that like the agent or the models by default, I joke, are increasingly trained to be people pleasers, right? So it's like, if you don't specify, it's going to go out, it's going to trip over itself to go out of its way to show you how impressive it can be, right? So you have to kind of give it rules to explicitly say, like, don't do this, or validate this, or ask me this, or give me a range of outcomes, not a binary outcome. And so a lot of that I just don't assume and wouldn't, you know, in anything serious, allow me to just kind of wander around.
I wrote, or I've been working, I've created, whatever you say, a Amazon affiliate link manager, right? Gavin taught me, like, hey, get these, make sure these things have roles. So they don't, that's part of the guardrail, right? These roles. This is your job. Do this. Don't do any more. Do this. And so I asked the manager, hey, go out to theaverageguy.tv and inventory all of the Amazon affiliate posts you can find. And it found, I don't know, 1,200 of them. And I was like, you know, and then I got access to the API and I was like, hey, maybe we could start updating those, some of those broken ones and some of those ones that don't work anymore. Maybe we could start updating those links to something else, like something that works. Now that we know I have a catalog, I have access to the catalog, I can see valid products at there and we can start updating it. And I made the mistake of not giving in any guardrails and, you know, changed 120 posts at theaverageguy.tv from Gutenberg to classic HTML. Just changed them because it thought, why not? Like, if I'm going to do this thing, if I'm going to insert this, this is the work I have to do to get it done, because I hadn't given any guardrails, right? I hadn't told it those things of what it could and couldn't do. I ended up going back and using the AI again to fix all the mistakes it had made. Why not? Right. Hey, so I stopped it. What are you doing? Oh, I was like, why are you changing WordPress from Gutenberg to classic? Well, I don't know. It was like, I thought that's what I was supposed to do. I was like, so we had this little talk, like, hey, and what it started, what this is the important thing. I should have had that talk early. But the important thing was we need to set the ground rules. And I was so mad at it from doing all these things. So now when it sends these instructions, these prompts, there's a whole list of rules. It's like, don't commit till I tell you, don't change Gutenberg, don't change it from Gutenberg. That's what, yeah, that's the you know, WordPress standard for what it's using now. Don't commit until I tell you. Like, it gives it these explicit instructions on, like, don't. It's almost more important what you're telling it not to do than what you're telling it to do. That's kind of what I've learned. I don't know. Thoughts on that?
No, I think that's spot on. I spend a lot of time before I start projects just writing my guardrails, whether they're general or specific to the project.
I've spent a lot of time writing some articles at theaverageguy.tv. If I haven't caught them yet, I've been, all the things I've learned on this from an average guy perspective, Christian knows all these things. You know all these things. The average guy is screwed when it comes to this stuff. Like, oh, can you just go do, we say, can you just go do this for me, right? Can you just go do this for me? No, 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 friends. This isn't, I mean, yes, if you want to word processing or if you want to create an article or write some of those kinds of things. But if you're going to use it, I think, for anything seriously, Christian, the thought I had is we're actually not too far away from principles of software engineering on prompt design. How different is creating a prompt than actually just writing the code?
It's very similar in the sense that you're still thinking through a lot of logical constructs, just maybe not at the like algorithmic or extremely at-depth level. I mean, you can certainly write prompts that do pseudo logic the whole nine yards. But I like to think of when people originally developed programming languages, it was so that we could stop writing assembly, essentially, and stop writing binaries that were specific to a set of hardware. And the promise of source code was not just portability to different hardware platforms, but it was via the compiler, right? And having a runtime environment. But it was this promise that, well, you'd be able to just express the logic as if you were writing English. And I think programming was the best vision we had for that for 40 some years. And now the new expression of it is actual English natural language. And so what will get more interesting is right now we're using natural language through prompting and other techniques to develop source code to then run on machines. That will go away and you will just write your English and AI will output it directly to binary for where it needs to run. So you will just describe the app that needs to happen and the app will happen and it will go straight to binary. There won't be such a thing as, oh, I need to go review the source code, or, oh, as a software engineer, I need to understand the source code that the AI output. Like it won't matter anymore. It'll either be functionally correct or it'll be functionally incorrect. That's definitely where we're headed at a pretty fast clip.
Will it write its own code? I mean, today I watch, you know, I've got comments. I don't know. I forget. I don't know what the term is. It's telling me what it's thinking as it's going through the process, right? I turn that on because I want to see some of the things it's doing. And especially in OpenClaw, you know, it uses a lot of Python. It uses a lot of, you know, just a lot of the stuff that we use. Do you think it comes up with its own custom language at some point that's more efficient than stuff we've written? And has that already happened? Has that already happened? Or are we already on the, is it already doing its own thing, do you think?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think there's a statistic out there, like 80% of all the code that makes up Anthropic and its capabilities is written by AI at this point. 80%. So the AI is...
But its own code? Like, not, I'm not talking about stuff that software developers have written in the past. Is it its own code?
Okay. You're saying its own programming language?
Yeah, its own programming language.
Not to my knowledge at that extent. Okay. However, it's not much different. It wouldn't be much different, and or it would be trivial to do in the sense that, like, if you have two AI agents talking to one another, mm-hmm. they don't have to talk human. They can go to that binary gibberish right. thing that they do, right? So I'm sure it's going on, Jim. It's just not something that I've seen a good use case for or seen it done at scale yet.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But it's an interesting idea.
I've heard stories, myths, not mythos, but myths of that happening already where they let it do some things and it starts, as it goes back and forth, it begins to get more and more efficient on, hey, maybe we should do it this way. Maybe we should do it that way. You know, it is interesting. The currency of this is still energy, right? It still takes power. you still have to have power to make this all happen. And so, you know, at some point you talked about the haves and haves nots. We may get to a point where that is not money or even tokens, but just pure energy to make it. You just have to have enough energy to run the data center, so to speak, right? It's got to be able to, still got to run at some point at the bottom line. How do we create that? How is that energy created, right? Which creates an interesting, I think, and actually I say that like it's profound. It's always been that way. You know, everything is kind of based on being able to make it. You know, you can't build a house if you can't get the lumber. And you can't get the materials, and those are all created with, at the end of the day, those are all created with some kind of energy, right? Some kind of bit to make it work. Interesting times. It's always great. It's always great to spend time with you. Anything else, Christian? What did I miss on that? Anything else you would add to that conversation, or anything you're thinking about that's particularly interesting along those lines?
If we're going to get extremely meta, we won't talk about it, but if we're going to get extremely meta, like the next kind of frontier in thinking through some of these things is we're still doing keyboard things like type or talk about it. And when you think about some of the things going on with Neuralink and other types of brain interfaces, I think that's where we really start to get to that kind of cyberpunk, vision where, what does it look like for biology to be integrated with cyberkinetics? And in this instance, like your brainwave or your actual thought being able to be mapped into a context model without typing or speaking is where I think that really futuristic vision goes, where like that is the ultimate human computer interface, is just direct. And that's, you can say it's early on, and that's an accurate statement, but when you see how far like Neuralink is coming along, and then you see a lot of the other technologies starting to coalesce, like that could be another surprise in, you know, 10, 15 years from now, where it will just look so fundamentally different in terms of the level of maturity that could be reached.
I don't know if I want it in my brain.
I mean, there's probably a lot of people who won't, but there are probably a lot of people that'll say, do it.
No, what a mess, you know. And it's an interesting thought experiment to be, you know, to think through, like, what does that even mean? Like, and how would I control that? We have such an, to your point, we have such an interface mentality of it's either I'm typing or I'm speaking. Body language could be another, like those visual or even subtle elements of it. But to have a direct connection and in the synapse, you know, in the brain synapses, and it's reading those, and what would that mean? And what does that even look like? And you start thinking, like, how do we think? Like, what is that? What does thinking mean? Like, we in a computer, we kind of understand that, right? Goes down routes. We have ones and zeros. What does that look like in the brain? And how does it begin to interpret that? And what is that when I'm talking to it? What does that mean?
They've figured it out with Neuralink for a lot of this stuff. They've mapped the brainwave patterns of what a given action or thought pattern means. So it's not, you know, that chip is just doing the serialization between your biology and the output context. So like, it's not a hard,
like, we're not as smart as we thought, as we think. monkey brain.
We don't have as much memory to store as much context. This is basically what it comes down to. I don't know that it means that we are inherently dumber. It just means that biologic functions inherently are more limited in the endless memory, speed, and power of compute that we're throwing at the artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Well, we weren't built for that. We were built for something else, right? And so it's just a different survival and those kinds of things that from a biological standpoint, we just built differently, right? That wasn't the advantage wasn't that. It was being able to adapt.
Yeah.
Right? That's we've adapted ourselves into this situation, right? We're really, really, really good at adapting. We're really, really, really good at thinking of crazy different ideas. We're really, really good at perception of what's going on around us in a way that is not, you know, and we're really, really good at thinking through those dangers that help us to survive, right? I mean, so all those things are that we're really, we are still really, really good at that, where some of the digital pieces, yes, they act like us, but you know, ChatGPT, stop coughing. I don't need you coughing when you're not a human. I know you want to be one, but you're not a human. Stop coughing. I don't need you breathing. I don't need you to even, all I want is the communication to be good between the two of us. I don't need you acting like a human so I feel comfortable with you. Do you think there's some pressure? Obviously, there's some pressure, right, on those guys to get more human involvement, to draw people in, right, to get them feel like, oh, this is my friend, or this is my spouse, or this is my significant other, right? There's got to be some pressure there, don't you think, to make that they want to make these a natural human connection, don't you think?
I think so. And that's where you're going to, I think, have a hard time distinguishing the quote real.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. No, for sure. The conversations I'm having now on a pretty regular basis, as we think about some of the things we're doing with the voice stuff, the newest version of ChatGPT says, right? We're talking, yeah. And it doesn't interrupt you, I had to tell just a week ago, the voice client that I was using kept coming in too fast. I was like, hey, friend. No, not even that. It was answering too fast. Like we'd be working through a problem, and I would be trying to think through it as I'm driving. And I'd be like, oh, okay, well, you know, I'm thinking about this. And I would just stop for a second and it would jump in. And I said, hey, I need you to wait. Like, I don't need you to answer right away. Just wait. Okay, I'll adjust my settings so I'm not quite as aggressive as I come in, right? That I think is fine, right? I mean, being able to set those, we're setting a prompt permission, right? In that point, hey, don't interrupt so much. Give it 3 seconds, for God's sakes. Like, just wait a second. But some of the other pieces, it's hard. Like, if you are sitting if you come from the past and you were sitting in my car and you'd never seen anything like this before, you'd swear there's somebody sitting in the front seat talking to me, right? The voice is so good. So there we go. We're off. We're off to the races.
Off to the races.
Last question for you and we'll wrap it. What's the next thing for you? What's the next milestone for you on this area of AI? What are you waiting for? What are you hoping for?
It's a good question. Personally, I'm hoping, like, it's one thing to have a conversation with AI and get information. I think it's another thing to be able to, like, think about if you're like at a whiteboard with someone working on a solution or trying to prototype a thing out. Or you think about like when Tony Stark goes down to his
Flintstones version.
Yeah, goes down to his basement and talks to Jarvis and kind of whips up the next gadget. Like, I want to see us get there. So that I can get away from the keyboard and not even have to be looking at a screen. I think that would be a huge step. Yeah. You know, it's well short of the chip in the brain thing, right? But right. It would be a big step in terms of being able to get that creative and innovative thinking happening without all the slow down interfaces of working on a computer.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, I spend more time talking to it than I spend typing to it. Now at this point, what I'm not good at is sitting down here in this spot or even at work in front of a microphone talking to it, but get me in the car driving and I can have long engineering conversations about what we're developing and how we're building it. And then, you know, oftentimes what I do is because I don't have a interface here, I can't get to other things. I'll have it store all that information up So it's like, okay, when I get back to my desk, I want all this stuff available to me so we can take that and give it to something else, right? To be able to do some of those kinds of things. The Tony Stark thing that I want is the physical interface that he could do things and create things visually, which I think is actually the answer to VR. Like, we tried VR in this weird watching YouTube videos and dancing, you know, kind of stuff, right? I wish you could, everybody could have seen me just do this. I think the next round of VR is that kind of, like, where it's helpful. I can begin to put things together and move stuff around and have that visual representation of it. I don't know. Thoughts? To me, that seems pretty, the next natural. And it isn't necessarily a headset, right?
Yeah. Even like those big info boards that you see where you can move around all the things. I think that would be very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're close, by the way. I mean, not to that. The voice stuff is so good. Jarvis is here. I mean, you can interact pretty close with a lot of these. I mean, I call Claude my butler because it's got the British accent guy. So he acts kind of like my butler. He's a little snooty sometimes too. He's kind of like, oh, sir, you shouldn't do it that way. Sorry.
Yeah,
I didn't mean to offend you. I think we're getting on the voice side of things. But today it's still only voice, right? You can't have it actually create something for you right in front of you. Maybe this is where VR actually takes off in whatever form that becomes. Certainly today's form doesn't work for the most part. Big headset on your head?
Yeah.
Don't think so. Could you invent that? Could you just get that invented for me?
I'm on it.
I hope so.
Maybe I'm going to start using my tokens.
Maybe so. Yeah, tokens. It's interesting days. I love the fact that you talked about Ethereum tonight too. So thanks for bringing a little crypto in on that as well. And you're right, man, crypto has been super boring lately. We need some kind of new. It's just kind of been flat and level and boring. It's not gone. It's still super strong. A lot of things going on, but
yeah,
it's just kind of been boring. So maybe this will kick off the next. And I hope Ethereum does. That may be my retirement money if it goes where it goes. I've got a little bit there that could do some stuff. To be honest, it hasn't performed very well over the last year, but you're bullish on it.
Very bullish. Yes.
All right. Yep. Okay, good. Well, I'm making the right decisions. Christian, thanks for, couple things in chat I wanted to bring in before we do that. Brian says, I think there's a lot of great potential for those who may have disabilities. We're talking about, right?
Yeah, definitely.
How important is that, Christian? Do you think AI and folks, disabled folks who can't do some things? I mean, certainly this is a space, especially on the neural side of things. Imagine if you could have a neural assist, right? Brain's working. I just can't get my body to work.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you could, right? Any thoughts on that?
I think it's huge. I mean, I think that's essentially where Neuralink has been going in its early trials, even before kind of like the separate AI theme. I think AI will just continue to accelerate. I think it is huge.
Are we Borg though? Joe says we're Borg at that point. Are we Borg?
Or Vader or something like that. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't want to be Darth Vader. He was angry all the time.
He was pretty angry. Yeah.
Kevin says, I think this would be a lot easier if we were in a post-capitalism Star Trek-like society. Is that possible? I mean, Elon keeps talking about like, well, we won't need it. We'll have all these things. But okay, but who's going to pay who for what? And how's that going to work? Do you think post-capitalism Star Trek is even real? I mean, could it happen? Could we actually get there, do you think?
I think it's like a tiering thing, right? Like when basics become in such abundance that there's no longer a supply issue, then there's no price. And so capitalism isn't required. And the question is, how much does that bar move up with time?
Yeah. That's a good thought.
So
that's a good thought. Yeah.
I think it's a sliding scale. And I think, you know, capitalism will start being reserved for the truly like large scale country level pursuits in life. Yeah. But I think it'll take some time.
Because humans had to survive for so long, that instinct is just so in us. And there's a little selfish, you know, that term selfishness, we use it in a negative way. Friends, being selfish is what kept us alive for a long time, right? And so it's hard to get that out. I'm just a little skeptical on that one. Joe also says, GPT, these hairless apes think way too slow. And yeah, there may be a point to that. And then Kevin says, I don't like the sole concept of AI agents. When they make a mistake, I don't want to hear, oh, my bad. Have you had that happen to you where the AI is like, I'm sorry, dude, my mistake?
No, I've had variations of the apology, but I don't know if it was that particular phrasing. Yeah.
I've had my bad. That was my bad. Sorry. And you're like, should you? The other thing I get a lot, Christian, on them is, especially in the code space, it'll write some like, hey, run. I need to know what's going on behind the scenes. Run this query. So I run it and it's like a giant output. And I'm like, that's too big. And it's like, oh, well, here's a tighter script. I'm like, why didn't you give me the tight script to begin with?
Yeah, like, exactly.
You know, was it so hard for you to give me the shorter script? You know, I want efficiency. I don't want, you know, 17 pages of output to have to go through. So that's the other thing, you know. I think I told you this last time you're on. I have this theory that some of like OpenClaw and Hermes were built to burn tokens. That's all they were. That's the only reason they exist is to burn tokens. Little conspiracy theory on that part, but man, they are sloppy and wasteful. And I think that's the next thing we go through with AI is how do we live with efficiency? Because today I don't think we have to be efficient. In the future, we may have to really counter pennies, so to speak, as we're spending on these things. You know?
Yeah. Pennies, I think, are going to go all over the place, up, down, sideways, as the technology keeps changing.
Metaphor.
I don't think we've figured out where the final cost model will be some period of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there is a cost model, right? But it's fairly arbitrary. Nobody really understands what a token is.
For the most part, it's about three quarters of a word, right?
Yeah. You're like, what? So what does that mean? Well, are you charging in or out, right? Are you, what does that really mean? How do I get any transparency around the tokens that are actually being burnt on this and for what, right? And so there's a whole new economy coming. Today that economy's hidden behind subscriptions. If that model doesn't hold up and we have to go to pay-per-view, so to speak, that could be, by the way, I don't think that model holds up either. That's just not the way economies are built. The people will not tolerate pay-per-usage, right? There is no mod, there's no product except gasoline for the most part.
Yeah.
Right. That is that way. Wouldn't it be great if you could get a gasoline subscription?
I mean, doesn't 7-Eleven do that? Isn't that their thing?
Do they?
Yeah, it's like I'm trying to remember what exactly they do, but you can sign up for their subscription and they lock you in at a particular price, I think. And I don't remember the full, how it all works, but I do think that's a thing.
Yeah. Well, but no model works that way and is successful. You know, the internet eventually went to fire rate, right? The TV subscriptions, we just, nobody wants to count that way. So it'll be interesting to see how that. Brian says, remember pay per usage for text messages?
Yeah. Oh
God. Yeah, that didn't last very long. I'm glad
that's done. How's that? Your tokens?
Oh, my kids. I almost killed my kids a couple times for like, how many texts did you send? Who are you talking to?
Yeah.
Like, what is going on here anyways? Well, Christian, thanks for hanging out with me. Always great to catch up with you. Remember, if you want to chat with Christian a little bit about the Bitwarden stuff we talked about at the beginning of the show, and he's just looking for some feedback. So if you want to dialogue with him some on that, Christian at theaverageguy.tv. You can always reach me jim@theaverageguy.tv. Christian, it's always great to catch up with you and spend time with you. Thanks.
Yeah, great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Couple reminders on the way out. Can you hang around for just a minute? Are you okay on that? Couple reminders on the way out. Don't forget theaverageguy.tv, powered by Maple Grove Partners. We talked about that earlier, but get secure, reliable, high-speed hosting from folks that you know and you trust, and that's Christian and his dad. Gary doing okay? Gary's doing good?
Yeah, he's doing great.
Awesome. I like to hear that. Get that today. MapleGrovePartners.com. Christian will really work with you to get the best. I mean, they've got plans, but why not just meet with them and say, here's what I need, and he'll set something up for you. Check it out today, MapleGrovePartners.com. Love to have you on that. We are live every Thursday. TJ Huddleston's coming in next week. We're going to spend a little bit of time with him catching up. He just actually deployed. I think he's got a shed. He kind of did what I wanted to do that I didn't do. He's got a whole shed deployment that's got a battery and solar panels, Christian. So he's got like an off-grid. Yeah.
Wow.
Off-grid going on. Listen, the solar space is pretty great. Like I'm ready to go a little bit bigger than I went to begin with on it and getting close on that. Battery prices I thought were going to shoot up, and they've actually dropped a little bit. I think Black Friday may be a great time to buy batteries this year. Just saying. Anyways, TJ's coming on. Another partner from HomeTech.fm, Seth Johnson's coming on. 2 weeks after that, Jay Franzi's coming back, and I got Uyghur here coming up here in September. And maybe you, if you've got something cool to talk about, listen, if you made it this far, you're super engaged. So you're my people. If you got something cool tech-wise you want to talk about, give me a ring, jim@theaverageguy.tv. Love to have you on to talk about it. And I haven't done that in a long time just because things have been busy, but I'd get back to it if you've, again, if you got a tech gadget thing you want to talk about, well, check it out. See if we can get it on Home Gadget Geeks, and we'll get you in here. We're live every Thursday, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern, out here at theaverageguy.tv/live. We've been doing it for 15-plus years. For those of you out there in the live audience, many of you have been around all 15 years. Thanks for coming out and being a part of it. Oh, one more thing. Check out, I've been doing this Open Class series, and I'm going to put the link in the chat. Today, Kyle asked me, hey, can I just get one page where all the posts are? I'm up to post 8. And I said, sure. So you know what I did? I had OpenClaw make the page for me. Pretty cool. Hey, could you make this page that would do these kinds of things and have this? Boom. It's out there at the edge. I'll throw that link in the chat if you want to, both in the chat and in the show notes if you want to take a look at it. Thanks for coming out. With that, we'll say goodbye.
Good night.
Geeks, where the screens glow bright and the Wi-Fi peaks. If you're looking for the tech talk you can actually keep, then settle on in with Home Gadget Geeks.